Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with a podcast and radio program that aims to do two things. We tell you about interesting and important events from around the world. And we present these stories in a way that helps you learn and improve your American English. Today we will tell you some new information that affects all of us. It is about health and who will take care of us as we get older. Then, something that might help keep us young. We will go dancing at a honky-tonk in the American West. Let's get ready to listen and learn with VOA, the voice of America. More than half of all people, 65 years and older, have no long-term health care. The International Labor Organization released the study recently. Researchers gathered information from 46 countries for the study, says the ILO. Those countries are said to be home to 80% of the world population age 65 and over. ILO officials say the study found a lack of social protection for the elderly and a worldwide shortage of 13.6 million workers to care for them. The report says 300 million older adults need a high level of health care. It says many of them cannot walk. Some have brain disease, such as Alzheimer's. Others need help for daily needs. Shinya Shale Adlung is the health policy coordinator at the ILO. She wrote a report on the study and its findings. She says the whole long-term care issue is neglected in many areas because of poor treatment of both the elderly and women.
This age discrimination and gender discrimination, but particularly age discrimination, is publicly not considered as a serious concern. Other than other forms of discrimination, we find that it is largely accepted that, for example, older people get less services, they are expected to consume less public funds. But if we compare rehabilitation services, which are needed both by younger and older persons, we find that older persons get much less.
The report says that Africa faces a shortage of 1.5 million long-term care workers. It adds that more than 90% of older persons there do not receive care. The report says the need for long-term health care workers is greatest in Asia and the Pacific. And it says the area has a shortage of 8.2 million long-term care workers. It adds that 65% of those over 65 in Asia and the Pacific need assistance. Older people generally receive better care in Europe. But the report notes that even European countries spend an average of only 2% or less of their gross domestic product on long-term care for the elderly. The GDP is the total value of the goods and services produced in a country during a year. The ILO says the shortage of workers means unpaid female family members will be forced to care for up to 80% of all older people who need help. The study says global populations are quickly aging, and few countries are prepared to deal with the increasing needs of their older citizens. The ILO is calling for the elderly to receive health care paid for by national social insurance plans or by taxes. It also says increasing the number of long-term care workers would both provide care for older people and create jobs. are listening to As It Is, a Learning English program from The Voice of America. Now let's have some fun. Katie Weaver has worked for The Voice of America for many years. She recently took a working vacation and traveled to the western part of the United States. She met some students at Northern Arizona University in a place called Flagstaff. On Wednesday nights, she says, many of the students like to go out for a little dancing at a famous local honky-tonk called the Museum Club. Well, let's let Katie tell the story.
Honky-tonks are dance and drinking places with reputations for getting wild and sometimes even a little dangerous. Country Western music is played, and the crowds do the two-step dance. The energetic and tricky dance is also sometimes called the Texas Two-Step or the Country Western Two-Step. The Museum Club is an iconic business along the historic U.S. Route 66. Two-stepping and drinking were not the club's first attraction. The building went up in the early 1930s. The owner, Dean Eldridge, built it to be the biggest log cabin in the world. Mr. Eldridge was in the taxidermy business. He displayed the animals he stuffed along the walls and beams of the business and called it a museum. Visitors back then also called it the zoo, a nickname that remains today. Signs of the Museum Club's past as a taxidermy business still remain. The heads of animals killed in hunting still hang in the club. They surround the dance floor as if to watch the dancers below. Riley Helsper is a manager and bartender at the Museum Club. She is also passionate about dancing. When I first started here, I had no idea how to dance. And now I'm a pretty great dancer, she said. She also noted the increasing interest in line dancing. This is when a crowd divides into straight lines to dance together. The dancers all carry out the same set of steps and move in the same direction at the same time. Definitely more songs are becoming line dances. It's shocking. Every week there's a new line dance, Helsper said. The Museum Club became a nightclub after Dean Eldridge died. It was a popular spot among the many thousands of people who traveled Route 66 each year. The club's atmosphere got rougher as the years passed. Bar brawls were not uncommon. And the club is said to have ghosts. In 1973, Don and Thorna Scott owned the business. The couple lived on the second floor. One night, Thorna Scott fell down the stairs and broke her neck. She died a few weeks later. Her husband never recovered, and his business suffered as well. Don Scott shot and killed himself inside the Museum Club in 1975. Manager Riley Helsper says there are reports of sightings of the ghosts of Don and Thora. She is often seen at the back bar, Helsper said. They both hang out. Don's not exactly a friendly character, but Thorna's a sweetheart. The Museum Club has live music at least three nights a week. Friday and Saturday is for country music. On Sunday night, the club features Latin music. The Museum Club also offers two-step lessons on weekdays. And Wednesdays are reserved for local college students to relax and have a little fun. I'm Katie Weaver.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. In most countries, crop harvest have increased between 3 and 5 times over the past 40 years. But harvest have grown at smaller rates or even stopped rising in African countries south of the Sahara. Technologies such as chemical fertilizer and hybrid seeds seem to have worked wonders in many areas. But why have they failed in Africa? Recently, Swedish and American researchers did field trials in Uganda on fertilizer bought from local markets and from producers. The researchers were from Stockholm University and Harvard University in Massachusetts. They tested 3 kinds of seed. Hybrid seed bought from producers or from local retail businesses, and normal seed that farmers keep from the harvest. They found that the fertilizer and seed from retailers was poor quality, says one of the researchers, Tessa Bold.
We found that about 30% of nutrient is missing in fertilizers, and that if you buy hybrid seeds from a retailer, they're about as good in terms of yields as if you were mixing 50% farmer seeds and about 50% properly authentic hybrid seeds.
Hybrid seed production is common in agriculture. Hybrid seeds are the product of mixing plants through sexual reproduction. Tessa Bold says the seeds and fertilizers sold at Uganda's local markets are not really worth buying.
We really do not know why the quality is lower. Anecdotally, people talk about, you know, adulteration. People like take little stones and paint them to look like seed, or they just pour in some farmer seeds and sort of mix them up like that.
Mary Sebakari operates an agriculture store in Kasaro, Uganda. She was surprised when told about the study's findings.
That one I cannot answer, because myself I don't mix. Some of the seeds which we have, they come when they are packed. So there is no how you can mix a thing which is packed.
Agricultural researchers launched a separate study in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Walter Haga works for a Belgian department agency. His team found that what were known as improved varieties of maize seed were no better than farmer seeds.
The improved seed, to my point of view, it's an ideology. Improved seed doesn't exist. You have to ask, what are you talking about? Are you talking about a variety that has a better performance? And if it has a better performance, where? Because varieties always have to be adapted to certain circumstances. Yes. In the context of Congo, nobody knows where this variety, this genetic, is really better than the local ones.
And that's the Environment and Science Report. I'm Marcia James.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. In November of 1840, the American people elected William Henry Harrison as their 9th president. Harrison was a retired general and a well-known Indian fighter. Many people considered him a hero for his victory over Native Americans at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811. Americans elected John Tyler as Harrison's vice president. The two men ran on the campaign slogan, "Tippecanoe, and Tyler too. Harrison was the first president from the Whig Party. Some Whig leaders, including Senators Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, believed they could control the newly elected president. Harrison asked Daniel Webster to edit the speech he planned to give after the swearing-in ceremonies. Webster removed some material from the inaugural speech and suggested other changes. The inauguration took place on March 4, 1841. It was the coldest inaugural day in the nation's history. Harrison spoke on the front steps of the Capitol building. He gave the longest inaugural address of any president. It lasted almost 2 hours. But Harrison did not wear a winter overcoat or hat. He got sick, probably from standing so long outside in the cold. Rest was his best treatment. But the new president was so busy, he had little time to rest. Harrison's health grew worse. Late in March 1841, he developed pneumonia. Doctors did everything they could to cure him, but nothing seemed to help. On April 4th, exactly 1 month after he became president, William Henry Harrison died. Vice President John Tyler was then at his home in Williamsburg, Virginia. Daniel Webster, the new Secretary of State, sent his son on horseback to tell Tyler of the president's death. The vice president was shocked. He had not even known that Harrison was sick. 2 hours after he received the news, Tyler was on his way to Washington. There was some question about Tyler's official duties. Harrison's death marked the first time that a president had died in office. No one was sure what the Constitution meant when it said that the powers of a deceased president should go to the vice president. Eventually, Tyler, Webster, and other cabinet members decided that Tyler should be president and serve until the next election.
That was a very controversial claim because people said, no, he's not the president. He's an acting president. He's just temporarily filling the office, but he's not president.
Historian Michael Holt taught at the University of Virginia. He says, although not everyone supported John Tyler's claim, he set an important example. He showed how power could transfer peacefully to the vice president after a U.S. president died in office. Tyler was sworn in as the nation's 10th president on April 6, 1841. He was 51 years old. No other man had become president at such an early age. Tyler was a slaveholding Southerner. He was born and grew up in the same part of Virginia as William Henry Harrison. His father was a wealthy landowner and judge who had been a friend of Thomas Jefferson. Tyler completed studies at the College of William and Mary and became a lawyer. He entered politics and served in the Virginia State Legislature. Then he was elected a member of Congress and later governor of Virginia. He also served as a member of the United States Senate. Tyler believed strongly in the rights of the states. As a congressman and a senator,
he had voted against every attempt to give more power to the federal government. In fact, historian Michael Holt says that in many ways, Tyler was more like a member of the Democrats, the opposing party at the time.
He favored the typical position of Democrats on what we could call domestic policy, which is that government is best which governs least. The less federal domestic policy you have trying to generate economic growth or improve society or whatever, the better.
In comparison, many Whig Party members firmly supported the ideas of a national bank, a protective tax on imports, and federal spending to improve transportation in the states. Tyler was just as firmly against these ideas. At the same time, many Democrats did not like the president either.
Most Democrats regarded him as a traitor who had jumped from the Jackson Party and joined the Whigs, however temporarily.
Michael Holt says even Tyler's appearance made him seem difficult and unpleasant.
You look at this guy and he's sort of aesthetically thin and with sunken cheeks and a long pointed nose. He just looks like he's unhappy with the world.
President Tyler quickly became even more unpopular over the issue of a new national bank. He wanted to establish such a bank in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The national bank could open offices in a state, but only if the state approved. Tyler's proposal was not the kind of bank most Whigs in Congress supported. They wanted no limits of any kind on the power of a national bank to open offices anywhere in the country. Whigs in Congress suggested a compromise. Bank offices would be permitted in any state where the state legislature did not immediately refuse permission. But President Tyler vetoed the compromise. He sent the bank bill back to Congress. The congressman wrote another bill. They said it was exactly what the president wanted. But the president did not agree. He said the states must have the right to approve or reject bank offices. He said this second bill would also be vetoed unless changes were made in it. The changes were not made, and Tyler did as he said he would do. He vetoed it. The decision created a crisis in the cabinet. All the president's advisors but one, Daniel Webster, resigned. Michael Holt says that several days later, most cabinet members and a large group of other Whig congressmen voted to expel Tyler from the party.
They read this paper saying he's no Whig. Don't blame us for all of his vetoes.
Harrison appointed a new cabinet of Whigs he hoped would be more friendly to him, but after a while, they too resigned. Michael Holt says Tyler made more changes in his cabinet than any other U.S. president. President Tyler struggled with his party over other issues. One was about import taxes. 2 years into Tyler's presidency, the government found itself short of money. It was spending more than it had. Congress decided that import taxes should be raised, some even higher than 20%. But President Tyler vetoed the bill. He said it was wrong to raise the tax so high and, at the same time, continue to give the states money from land sales. He said the federal government itself needed the land sale money. Michael Holt says once again the Whigs were angry. Their party controlled both houses of Congress and the White House, but they could not reach their goals.
The Whigs were elected with this agenda that they wanted Congress to pass, that they had promised would rescue the country from a very serious depression. And this included a new national bank, higher tariffs, distribution of federal revenues from public land sales.
President Tyler, he adds, frustrated the entire Whig legislative program. It was clear the Whigs would not nominate him for the next election, so Tyler turned his attention to the Democrats. He hoped they would ask him to be their presidential candidate in 1844. Tyler began appointing Democratic advisors to his cabinet, and he gave his support to one of the Democrats' causes, making Texas a state in the Union. Texas was an independent nation at the time. Some Americans wanted to bring Texas into the United States to further expand the country. But others were afraid that the territory would permit slavery. They wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler had the opposite fear. Michael Holt explains that Tyler was afraid that Texas would remain an independent republic and abolish slavery there.
He and other Southerners thought that that was a terrible idea, but he also believed that this is what's going to put him in the history books, that he's going to be responsible for adding this enormous Republic of Texas, although it wasn't quite as big as what they claimed, to the United States.
The election of 1844 and the question of Texas statehood will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.